C1A. Number 10A.
They're taking that fourth subject on principle in Atonement and Eucharist, and I just want to go over the main line of it, just to keep in thought the main subject. What does it tell us? It says, fundamentally, man is one with what? With the fundamentals of principle, with the scientific foundation of atonement. But atonement says we must exemplify this unity with the fundamentals of principle. How? It's always through the Eucharist. It's always through laying down the counterfeit of it. And therefore here it is by laying down, by giving up within oneself the counterfeit of a fundamental principle, namely theories, doctrines, personal views, personal interpretations, outward worship, and so on. See, how does Mrs. Eddy show that? She compares the principle of being with the doctrines of men, with the theological doctrine of atonement, and asks us to atone with the scientific sense of atonement. How? She asks us to atone with mind, as mind says, in order to atone, we have to acquaint ourselves with the word of revelation, with the word of God, the original text of the Bible. It's first an atoning with the original revelation of God. And giving up, that's the Eucharist, giving up the interpretation of priests and hierarchies, personal interpretation. Then she goes to the subtone of spirit and says, this word of revelation to which we have to atone through our seeking and searching for it, this word of revelation must be understood spiritually, and its spiritual interpretation must be made our atonement and not its theological interpretation. Then in the subtone of soul, she can go on and says, because only the spiritual interpretation, if we are at one, if we are one with the spiritual interpretation of atonement, of the unity with God and man, can something change in us. Only that can work changes. Only that has a transforming power. Whereas the outward, just the worship, the material worship of Jesus' blood and his sacrifice has no redeeming power, has no changing power. It cannot redeem us from sin. And so we see that this transforming power, which we only get through that subtone of mind, of seeking the word of God and knowing the word of God, of worshipping that revelation spiritually and not outwardly, that gives us that transforming power. That transforming power, she shows in the subtone of principle, we must exemplify in our life, must be exemplified through our obedience. If you love me, keep my commandments, she says there. We must exemplify our obedience to the divine principle and not just profess to that divine principle. Not just think about it and inwardly think about it and say, yes, it is so, but just exemplify it through your obedience. What does that mean to exemplify these commandments? He goes on and says, well, that's real life. So he comes to principle as life and says, that's real life. That's your showing forth your worthiness by going the way of life, by not shunning individual experience, that we are willing to go through the experience which Jesus went through, and ask us to drink the cup as he did. That's being atoned with a scientific sense of life, of atonement. So this obedience, you see, to the divine command always leads us to life and says that gives us life experience, quite new life experience. Naturally, the moment we are, it's quite logical, the moment we atone ourselves inwardly with a new principle, with a divine principle instead of a theological principle, with a new principle, then something new is going to happen. The life becomes very different. And here it is the new life, the real life that begins to break in through going that loving pathway in speechless agony. And sometimes it is speechless agony. But does it matter? It's only because the human doesn't want to yield to the divine. And so she goes on and says, and through this life experience, she goes on and says, man is equipped really then with the divine authority and has authority. Again, you see what we have seen always again when she touches the subtone of life and truth. She says that really we become only man and we gather only the true nature of man, and that we only find in us the Christ man in the measure as we are willing to go through that tone of life, through the life experience, are willing to sacrifice human self and sense. We always have seen that, you see, that without that, we are always only on the surface. We only have a visionary sense of the true man. We are not experiencing the true man. And so here in truth she comes and says, well, that going through those experiences, what does it bring forth? It brings forth the real Christ man in us, the godliness, the divine nature which animated Jesus, that godliness in us which has authority. And then, at last, in the tone of love, we have seen how she shows that this authority, however, is there to serve the purpose of God and not our purposes. Let's think of that. That atonement, you see, that the purpose of atonement is to find God, to find ourselves in God. And that it isn't, that the purpose of Christian Science of Atonement is not to find the power of God, to use it at our discretion. That's the word. Thank you very much. At our discretion. See, she, the whole thing goes back to God, always in the tone of love, where the idea is brought back into the bosom of love, into the plane of love, and we see that we are God's tools and are used as God's tools. So in that last sentence, subtone, she showed how that atonement, which is founded on principle, must prove that God is the power behind the messianic work, and that this power is really only then used scientifically and not humanly when it is served for the purposes of God and not of men, of the human men. Can you see the sequence in it? How it starts very gentle with seeking the original text of the Bible and getting away from a theological sense of the Bible, just as we have to get away from a theological sense of the text of the textbook, from a immature or ignorant knowledge of the textbook to a real, loving, deep-felt, spiritual sense of the textbook. And if we see the spiritual sense of the textbook, that has transforming power. See, what she says here, really, we have done in quite an extent when Mr. Dolly explained the Bible to us. He was the one who said, I am going to show you the original meaning of the text. He took the original meaning of the text. He didn't take anything else in account, no human interpretation into account. And then what did we do? He gave us the love for it, the subtonal spirit. Can you see that therein is a big love in that whole story? You remember how he showed always the one story, the big story, the only story, the one story, until we just loved it. And so the comforting and redeeming sense of that thing. And that sense, so we were able to grasp to a certain extent the spiritual meaning, the spiritual essence of that text, of that Bible. And that, the spiritual meaning, the spiritual sense of the Bible could do anything to us, could give us reassurance and comfort and everything. The spiritual sense of it, not the text itself. Well, so we see, when you go through this fourth subject, see this story. You know, I would like you to be as principled and disciplined as you can. Everyone has perhaps his and her own difficulties. But you have three subjects to ponder in the next 8 weeks. Well, make a little plan for you. Take a fortnight for the first subject to ponder, that is the subject of soul, the other fortnight for the subject of principle, and the third fortnight for the subject of life. Give yourself time, and then you have still another fortnight left. You just can ponder over the whole thing and see the rhythm of the whole thing. But you know, anyway, if I can talk from my experience, I take weeks to get the touch and the rhythm of these things. I can't do it in an evening and say, well, tonight I have an evening left. I think I will take that to prepare for the next talk. I just can't do it. When I come home, usually I have to attend to one or the other thing for a day or two or 3 days, and then I start to prepare for the next talk. And every day I am at it. What I tell you is not just that which I prepare a few days before I come here. It's always that which I have done every day for quite a few hours during the 8 weeks. And I can't do it otherwise. But you will find, after a certain time, everything needs experience and needs starting and then trying and trying again and putting some more love into it until it becomes definite. You will find that if you do that and you carry with you gently, lovingly, just as a mother carries her child, protecting it, loving it, keeping everything away which wants to detract it, and you carry a subject, one of these subjects, for a fortnight, day in and day out. You go out on a bus and you have to stand queues over here, so there is a possibility to think about it and to ponder it, and there is a possibility, and there is a few minutes, and there is a half an hour. You carry it with you. They just here a little, there a little, here a little, there a little, and you will find that the text renders 100 times more than what I tell you, or what you could grasp just by listening to me. It just renders. Why does it render? Because there we have found the law of creation, the law of the world of life, which says, start with mind, start with seeking. If you touch that, then you touch the whole world of God. And the whole world of God says, after mind, mind leads you unweigerlich, irresistibly, irresistibly. To spirit. It leads irresistibly to spirit. What does it mean that it leads irresistibly to the spirit? It leads irresistibly to the new birth. But something is born in our consciousness. You just can't help it. Suddenly something comes, springs into life, and something is newly born. And then that's the thing which you love most. That is the thing which you will love 10 times and 100 times more than what I tell you about it, because it's born of you. Comes out of your own loins. It's your child, it's your baby, and therefore it's nearer to you and warmer to you and more tangible to you, and you will love it more and more and more, and you will love it so much that you can't help that the third day springs into focus, that becomes something new in you, your new being, that it becomes you through identification, that it, that new child, that new idea becomes you, and you feel that more true about my being, that my old being, that my physical being and my corporeal being, that's my being, and you identify yourself with the spiritual quite naturally. Can you see how a soul comes in, the third stage comes in? And the moment that third stage comes in and you feel, oh, there is the new identity of my true identity coming into light and springing into light, becomes more tangible, more real, more concrete, you have a feeling, well, that is going to govern me. And you come to principle, quite naturally, you can't help it. That begins to govern us. And it begins to govern us in every detail. That's what principle does. It always governs every detail. Principle is not just a central point somewhere up there, but it's always reduced to a system, therefore always governing all details. And so it begins to govern our thoughts, our emotions, our motives, our life, our being, our speech, our actions, our emotions, everything. It begins to govern, and govern, it becomes quite naturally to principle. Well, if it comes quite naturally in this way into our being, then something is happening with us. We have quite a new life, and you come to life. It drags us out of an old rut of life. It takes us, it exalts us out of a material of an old traditional belief of life. It drags us out. That's your exaltation of the fifth day, of the birds flying above the water into the open firmament of heaven. You feel you get out of this world. You leave the world behind quite naturally. Well, if that happens and you feel lifted and lifted and lifted, you feel, well, something new, big is taking place. The new consciousness. It's a new consciousness where the universe just becomes one big consciousness. And you come to the sixth day, to the compound idea. But just can't help it. See, and that leads us to the end of the days of creation. You see, it's always, if we start right, then the days of creation is not something where we say, now what is the first day? And we say, well, it's let there be light. And so, oh yes, it's let there be light. And then I must go to the second day. What is the second day? The second day is spirit, the spirit separate. That's not an order. That's counting up things. That's having seven different compartments. It's not unfoldment. It's just remembering something, but it isn't the order of the world. An order is always when one thing comes out of the other. Mrs. Eddy says Christian Science presents unfoldment, not accretion. That's accretion if we say, what is the first day? Oh, the first day is this and this. What is the second day? Well, then I come to the second day. The second day I have learned is this and this. That's accretion. That doesn't do a job. That doesn't do a thing. That's no order. Order is, you remember, that's why I tried to put that down in that little pamphlet, Why Study Christian Science as a Science, before I started these talks. Because I wanted to show very clearly and definitely something which we have all known for ages and which Mr. Dorley and everybody has said before and before. I wanted to have it down once black on white. That a science is only then a science when the facts of science are interrelated. If they are not interrelated, we have no science. We can have a million facts. If they are not interrelated, they don't constitute the science. They just constitute a knowledge of a million facts, but not science. Science is always taking these facts and putting them into interrelation. They must be interrelated, and then they become one. And so it is with science, with the Christian Science. Just to know some divine facts without any order in them, without any spiritual interrelation within them, It doesn't give the oneness of being. It gives quite the other way around. It gives the split up of the being in million facts. Only then, when we see that these facts just come out, one out of the other, is an unfoldment. Just as you see it, you may see it in nature, that out of a little stem comes out all sorts of blades and flowers and so on, out of one root. That's unfoldment. And so it is here. And so let's culture that. The material sense will try to stop it, but the spiritual sense sees that if we culture that, it becomes natural. What does happen when it becomes natural? What does happen when the 7 days of creation become a natural unfoldment, not something which we have learned by heart? The seven days of creation learned by heart, they have not a single iota of power in itself. Not a single iota of power. But the 7 days of creation lived through, seeing how they are impelled by the divine law that exists, which is outside of the human reach, but which is impelling us to accept it. If we get that wonderful order, what does it do? It establishes the new creation. It establishes the Word of God, and by the Word of God, all things are created that are created. And the Word of God creates only spiritual things, and that's the only thing that really are. And so we find there the answer to our material creation. We find in that culturing of these 7 days of creation, I mean the culturing of it, not the learning it by heart, not the reiterating it in terms and words and speeches, but that touch of it, that feeling that order and becomes definite that order, that is the answer to creation, to material creation, to the Adam dream. That's the answer to our creation. And if we want to have life eternal, we must have that creation which is impelled by the divine life and not an improvement of that creation which was impelled by sex. That creation cannot be improved. That must be laid down. And so what we find is, what we are engaged in is an enormous big thing and not a little thing. Finding true being. Well, that was a little digression from the tone of principle. But there it is. In doing this work at home and in pondering, you will feel that with every month, with every other month, these tones become tangible in consciousness, not in thinking, but in consciousness, in spiritual consciousness, and that they become real and that they become comforting. There's some comfort behind it. I can't express it why. It's some comfort behind it because it says, I can show you the way. I can lead you the way. Well, if we regard now this fourth subject and see how it counteracts the theological concept of atonement. We find out, we see something which gives us the key to the next subject of life. Namely, when you read that fourth subject through, you can't help feeling that though it is mainly speaking about the tone of principle, that she always couples that principle with life somehow. Because she always would say it is the Bible is the chart of life. See, the system of life. I just read you a few passages out of principle and not out of life to show you how she always says it is the principle of what? Here it is not the principle of anything, it is the principle of life. She says that his true flesh and blood were his life, that Jesus taught the way of life by demonstration. He demonstrated the divine principle of being. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. His mission was to reveal the science of what? Celestial being. See, always she couples always here science with being, and we will see why afterwards. It was the divine principle of all real being. Well, she could have said of all real healing, or the divine principle of economy, of the divine principle of medicine, or could have said many things about the divine principle. It's always of being, of being. It was the divine principle of all real being which he taught and practiced. His proof of Christianity was Christian Science working out the harmony of life and of love. Why? Why this? Why does she always say it's the principle of life, of being, of existence? Because she contrasts is here the principle with theology, you see, with the counterfeit of with theology. Well, what has theology done with atonement? It has killed it. Theology has made a dead doctrine out of it. It has taken that wonderful example of Jesus to show through atonement what? Life. That God is life. That's his climax. He had to prove in the 5,000 year period that God is life. And his whole life mission went out to prove that life is spiritual and therefore that life is indestructible. But theology, what has theology done with it? It has made a dead doctrine. Something very dead. Something which you don't have to live. Which you only have to do the necessary rituals and the necessary confessions and professions to it. It made a doctrine which is dead as a dodo. See? Whereas what we have to see is that we don't profess to atonement and to a principle of atonement which is just a profession, but which is a life and which is proving life. And so she starts that fifth subject, the new fifth subject writes in. For the first time she says that life is God. See, Jesus proved by his reappearance after the crucifixion in strict accordance to his scientific statement. See, again he proved his statement. He had his statement, theology takes and makes another dead statement out of it and gives birth to a new, very complicated doctrine in a language which nobody of us can understand and unless we have a very special dictionary where we can look up all the various words they use so that nobody can understand them except a few highbrow professors. It's not living, see. But what he showed, or what Mrs. Eddy showed it here, is that after she had presented that we atone with a scientific foundation of atonement and not with a theological foundation of atonement, not a ritualistic foundation of atonement, she shows, but for what? And she shows it is for life. It is for exemplifying life and not for anything else. And so she starts and says, and that life is God.